The Dr. and Mrs. Future program.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents The Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. This hour, we're going to be talking about the Beatles and the gods of rock. Yes, we're going to be having...
And the doors of perception.
The door and how it all connects. We're having author Steve Wagner on. He's 30 years of experience in a wide variety of entertainment industry fields. He's a member of the San Francisco Film Critics Circle. And he was co-host and written and executive producer of the Bay Area television program Film Trip. Reviewing over 1,000 films, interviewing over 300 actors, directors, writers, musicians. Steve was a singer and a guitarist for the Backsliders, a touring rock band in the 80s, performed over 800 shows, opened for many national acts. For over a decade, Steve was director of the San Francisco Art Exchange, which is a gallery specializing in rock and roll photography and original album cover art. He brokered sales for many of the world's most famous album cover original artworks, including Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah, Steve has had his ear to the keyhole of many of the insider stories of rock and roll, and he's a fabulous storyteller himself.
Yes.
We're very happy to have him joining us today.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Steve.
It's great to be with you guys, good doctor and fine Mrs. Future.
Yes, for those who might find it interesting, we got to know Steve a little bit at a memorial for a dear friend that passed last May.
Yes, our dear friend Michael Gosney brought many of us characters together so that we are now becoming friends with each other, even though before then we didn't really connect too much.
Yeah, and Steve, you're talking to Son and myself and Bobby Wilder.
Do you remember me, Steve?
Hi, Bobby.
We were talking about Joseph Campbell, actually.
It was a fabulous conversation.
Yeah.
So let's look at the story arc of this a little bit. You're covering a lot of material in All You Need Is Myth. Could you tell us what your passion was to why you wrote this book?
Well, I became so fascinated by the topic once it sort of occurred to me.
Uh-huh.
I was selling the rock and roll fine art and album cover art for the San Francisco Art Exchange. And to make a fairly long story short, I was always asking myself, where does the value come from? What are people really, really responding to when they spend a fair amount of money for these artworks? And it occurred to me that there was a difference between the artists who have become highly collectible in that realm and the artists that maybe outsold those other artists 10 to 1, but they have not become iconic with time.
Can you give us an example of that? Somebody that's been very popular but not iconic through time?
Well, sure. One example would be maybe The Doors. Jim Morrison is an icon, a cultural icon that gets bigger and bigger with time.
Yeah.
In just about that exact same time period, you had Three Dog Night, who were one of the biggest selling acts in popular music for about that 5-year stretch.
Yeah.
And yet Three Dog Night is not a collectible, iconic icon or a collectible entity in, say, the fine art world, where Jim Morrison and The Doors most definitely is. And it was sort of those questions that made me say, what is distinguishing these artists from everyone else? And it finally dawned on me that it's because they're resonating classic mythic archetypes. Like the prophet and the savior and the devil and the goddess and the spirit and things like that. And then you start peeling that onion back and it just keeps going and going. I thought it would take me about a year to write the book. It took 10 years to write the book because That's how deep the subject matter went.
So are you suggesting that these rock gods are kind of like the Roman or Greek pantheon of gods and in the meaning that they hold for our society, for our, at least our generation?
Very much so. And, of course, it's communicated in a different way, and that's one of the reasons why it seems like maybe it's different. But all one has to do is consider the very nature of mythology itself. Mythology always reinvents itself with any new culture or any new language. And in the 60s, we had this new language of mass media. And that's really one of the demarcations here. Once we can realize that we were just communicating with a different language of mass communications, it almost was inevitable that a mythology was going to arise within that new communication model. And I think that's exactly what we saw with these iconic rock stars of the 60s.
And Marshall McLuhan also was the language. We started to have a language for mass media that perhaps these rock stars were utilizing.
Well, absolutely. There's a fair amount of McLuhan philosophy in All You Need Is Myth. Because it's quite interesting, because he was literally changing the world at the exact same time. And you can look back at some of the things that he was predicting in the 1950s, and those predictions literally came to life with some of these rock stars. In many cases, I was looking at a number of these serious innovators in a number of different fields, like Marshall McLuhan with mass media, Joseph Campbell in mythology studies, Carl Jung in psychology, and they all seem to be pointing at the same thing from different fields of study. But what they seem to be pointing at can be explained most vividly in the phenomenon of the Beatles and the 60s music renaissance.
Now, they didn't start off this way. They became epic, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, they started their career right as Elvis was in his prime. And you could say that mass media of radio and the record industry is where Elvis had his meteoric rise to fame. And then television really shined its light on the Beatles.
That's very true. In fact, one of the demarcations between Elvis and the Beatles, I think, is the fact that television and mass communications had really reached an apex by the time of, let's say, the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, which was a watershed cultural event for the Western world.
Steve, let's talk about that when we come back from
the
break.
We've got to
take a little moment. And then we'll talk about the watershed moment of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Talking to Steve Wagner, author of All You Need Is Myth, The Beatles and the Gods of Rock. Okay, welcome back to the show. We're talking to Steve Wagner, who has written All You Need Is Myth, The Beatles and the Gods of Rock. And we're looking at how really rock became a religion for real. And we're about to talk about the watershed moment of Ed Sullivan's show when the Beatles came on. Why was that a watershed moment in your understanding mythically, Steve?
Because it cohered a culture that the world literally had never seen before. By 1964, 1965, 40% of America was under the age of 20. This is the baby boom. This had never happened before. So you have this emergent culture that is literally suffering an extreme existential crisis following the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
And so whether they knew it or not, literally half of the country was sort of searching for a new savior, so to speak. You can kind of see how media was coalescing around JFK, the fact that his family has been associated with the idea of Camelot,
right?
Literally right. from the yeah. beginning of his presidency,
yeah.
I think is a great indicator of the mythic status that JFK was assuming. And all of a sudden, he's gone, and America is existentially adrift.
Yeah.
And one of the things that mythology accomplishes for cultures is cohering those cultures and the people around a common idea or a common character. And in this case, you had these new mythic heroes, the Beatles, and literally all it took was an hour of television for the entire Western world to say, yes, we want.
They were popular, but they weren't going to, I don't think they were going to build a new Camelot. It was a different kind of.
They were just trying to write hit songs.
Yeah.
What did they perform? I Want to Hold Your Hand. Wasn't that their big hit at the time?
It was their big hit here, yes. They performed five songs on that original show. They did All My Loving, Till There Was You, She Loves You, I Saw Her Standing There, and I Want to Hold Your Hand, which was the watershed hit that they were writing when they were literally on Ed Sullivan for the first time.
So all very popular romantic love songs.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand is a very, very interesting love song. It's not something I talk about directly in the book, although it was something I considered talking about.
Yeah.
If you consider the idea that what they're saying is, I want to hold your hand. I'm going to hold your hand and take you through this experience. It's really not a standard boy-girl love song in a classic sense. It's more of the Beatles offering their hand to a generation.
To
I think that's sort of an allegory, but it's one way to see the impact of that song.
Uh-huh. They're going to lead us through some new experiences, huh?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Which they did. That's part of their story arc.
Well, I like to think of it as that we all grew up there before my time a little bit, but what happened is knowing how their music changed over the arc of their career, they grew up with their generation, and they started out as these sort of teeny boppers, you know, these innocents that were very interested in boy-girl flirtation and dynamics in an era that was still very religious and very conservative compared to today, and pre-civil rights and pre-summer of love, the egg had not been cracked yet.
Mm.
And
that's true.
Then as it got cracked, their music was the shifting of consciousness. So it rode the wave.
Absolutely. The Beatles were both a catalyst for the culture and a reflection of the culture, and their continual evolvement as artists produced a story arc through the 60s that is remarkably similar in terms of allegory to what Joseph Campbell described as the hero's journey in his groundbreaking 1949 book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. When we look back now, we can see this arc where the death would have been their decision to stop touring, to stop appearing live.
Hmm.
And then they transformed with an album called Revolver. They resurrected with an album called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They resurrected with a new sound, a new look, a new approach to album cover art. And then you have The Ascension, which is All You Need Is Love, being performed on the very first global satellite broadcast in the summer of 1967.
Hmm.
You've got that song literally rising above the earth and beaming out to 400 million people. And what are they doing? They are aligning themselves with the concept of love, which is an absolute crucial aspect of the hero or the savior archetype.
Mm-hmm. That's what they're bringing back to us as what they have to share from their adventures. And exploring reality. They had quite a show with that, too. They were speaking with Eastern gurus at one point.
Yes.
Maharishi.
Maharishi, I think, was part of that.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's, I guess, what distinguished them from other groups like the Monkees, which were kind of...
Well, the Monkees is a very interesting phenomenon as well. And I think in terms of the Beatles, the Monkees were one of the best things that happened to the Beatles because they sort of held on to the little kids who were maybe just a little too young to make that leap from literally from Yellow Submarine to Strawberry Fields Forever. All of a sudden, those tiny tots had the Monkees for a couple of years to keep them occupied, and then they got a little bit older, and then they were at a point where they could experience the more mature Beatles and join back into that greater fray.
Join the revolution just in time to drop out.
Exactly.
Did Yoko come onto the scene when the Beatles were breaking up?
John and Yoko actually met quite early. They met, I believe, for the first time in 1967. By the time the Beatles went to India to study transcendental meditation with the Maharishi, John and Yoko were already corresponding. And he was still married to Cynthia at that time. In fact, she went with him, as all the wives went with the Beatles to India. But John was becoming more and more fascinated with Yoko and her very, very unique approach to art. I believe that this is one of the more innovative, may not be the right word for it, but interesting aspects of my book, is that it puts Yoko into a very different perception. Essentially, I argue in the book that without Yoko, the story of the Beatles does not have the proper mythic ending.
Wow.
Because John and Yoko were a resolution of duality. That would be one of the elements to heaven, to ascension, to resolve duality. Here they're resolving Eastern and Western culture.
East meets West with them. Male meets female.
Yeah,
yin meets yang.
Well, they're most definitely the yin-yang. They're the lover's card in the tarot. They resolved commercial and experimental art, Eastern and Western culture, male and female. It's one of the things that provides a mythic ending to the story of the Beatles that I'm not sure could have been achieved any other way.
Didn't she inspire him to write Imagine?
Well, she was most definitely, her conceptual art focus was a huge influence on John's songwriting at the time with songs like Instant Karma and Imagine. She wasn't really a member, but she was very close to the members of what was known at the time as the Fluxus movement out of New York, which was a very radical, interdisciplinary art movement that stressed mass participation. So when you've got John writing songs like Give Peace a Chance and Power to the People, these are attempts through pop music to bring people together and inspire community action. And I think those motifs most definitely were inspired by
You mean
Yoko.
Like the advertising campaign, like war is over if you can receive it? Merry Christmas, John and Yoko.
Yes, war is over if you want it, which really became, also grew into one of the great Christmas classics of the last 50, 100 years, which was Happy Christmas, War is Over. That's another example of these sorts of inclusionary songs that John was writing that were most definitely inspired by Yoko.
We got another break here, Steve.
Got to go to a news break, Steve. We'll be right back. We're talking to Steve Wagner, author of All You Need Is Myth, The Beatles, and The Gods of Rock.
And I hope our callers will be patient. Because
yes, we've got some callers already. Okay, welcome back to the show. We're talking to Steve Wagner, author of All You Need Is Myth, The Beatles, and The Gods of Rock. And I want to really understand how rock and roll became as important as religion. But first, We have some callers. Are you open to talking to some callers, Steve?
I'd be glad to.
Okay. Okay, we have Shane on from calling from Australia. Shane, welcome to the show.
Yeah, g'day, Steve and Mrs. Future. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll be quick. I just wanted to comment that, I look at the generational shifts, and I'm old enough to remember when the Beatles did come out because I remember Dad going to a petrol station and getting a free record, and I'm not sure the record was. It was a little 45, and we got a picture of the Beatles too, and then we refused to have a haircut for next year until we had hair like the Beatles.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that.
The British invasion, you know, long hair.
Yes. When the Beatles went to Australia, they were literally, that was the absolute height of Beatlemania. It was one of the most rapturous receptions that they received anywhere in the world. Hundreds of thousands of people were lining the highways. They played in New Zealand a few shows and a few shows in Australia. You can see, you can find footage of them at their hotel, maybe in Sydney or in Melbourne. And it's just, the scene, it's people for as far as you can see. It's just mind-boggling how big they were at that point when they went to Australia.
What do you remember about that craze there, Shane? Did you get sucked up into it?
Well, look, I was blessed enough because, you know, my field's behavioural and looking at generational social engineering. But I really see another side of the music industry of that time, because what I saw was older brothers start getting into the aspects of what they were singing about, and they all got pretty heavily into the drug side of things and the things that were actually being sold through a lot of the music, especially the Rolling Stones. And I had a sister tragically get involved in the heroin, because the strange thing about it was, when all the music hit in this country, so did all the drugs. You had every drug under the sun start coming into this country.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, well, those two things really rose in tandem. At the time, the Beatles got blamed for influencing the kids along the line. I think that they were influenced by the changes that were happening. Like we were saying before, they were both a catalyst and a reflection. But you had the invention, the discovery of LSD, actually in the late 30s, but it wasn't until the early 60s that it became well known and started to be experimented with by the intellectuals and eventually the youth culture. So it was really, you had a number of things that were expanding at the same time, and I think one of the reasons for that was, again, media being at an apex at that time. By the late 70s, we were already becoming fractals in our media, with even just cable television. Something like that sort of changed the dynamic. In the 60s, we only had 3 television networks in the United States, and the top 40 stations all played the same songs. The entire culture, and certainly the youth culture, we're all experiencing the same sights and sounds at the same time. They were really entrained together, and that is one of the rock-solid things that mythology will spring from, when a culture is focused on the same thing at the same time.
I think that's a really fascinating thing that you're focusing on there, Shane, is the simultaneity of the music revolution and, Steve, what you're bringing in, a focus on the media and what an effect that had, and also the change in consciousness facilitated by the drugs, which I think we've had a few conversations on this show, how that was the newly enlightened, media-savvy public responding to the reality of televised war, to the atomic bomb, to the bringing the Vietnam War onto television, and the shock that that was to our society, and people just trying to tear down the status quo that created all of that. So media was really very much at the core of that.
You're absolutely right,
son. I'll let you guys go. And look, thanks for the program. I love the program, and great work, Steve.
Thank you so much, Shane. It's great talking, my friend.
Now, what I want to know is, are the Stones and the Beatles the same religion?
Well,
they're two sides of the same coin, aren't they?
Okay. So they are. They are part of the same.
Well, absolutely. The second that you've got a savior, you're going to need a devil. Or the second you have a devil, you're going to need a savior.
The nature of dualistic reality. Yeah.
And you're also talking about the rescuer-victim-perpetrator triangle, which is a classic mythic formula, as well as a psychological shortcut for understanding how victims relate to...
Victim, rescuer, persecutor.
Yeah,
that's
to reality.
Classic Hollywood writing.
Right. Yes. And it's also really no secret at this stage of the game that the Stones were kind of groomed to be the anti-Beatles. Their manager in the early 60s, Andrew Lug Oldham, had worked for Brian Epstein, and he recognized that you had your good guys in a movie. We needed the bad guys in the movie, too. And the Stones were marketed as sort of the evil opposite of the Beatles, and they wrote that motif all the way through the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Huh. But the Beatles were the ones that were famous first.
Well, absolutely. They really broke the door down for everyone in England. And prior to the Beatles, there were some mythic archetypes that were being expressed through popular music. Most notably Bob Dylan as the prophet archetype and the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson as the child archetype.
The child? You mean innocence? Surfing in California, not care in the world? Kind of innocence?
Well, yes. In terms of that, Carl Jung writes extensively on the idea of the child archetype being sort of an anthropomorphization of the concept of paradise. The Garden of Eden, the innocence from which we collectively emerged. The child is a symbol for that in mythologies, at the roots of religion.
Yeah.
And with the Beach Boys, what do you have? You have the exact same symbols being communicated. Eternal youth, healing water, gold, which stands for purity. What would be another one? You know,
fun. It's serious fun.
Well, absolutely. I mean, but this child archetype, it's all part of the California dream, which has to do with the history of America, too. This is one of the reasons why this is a very, very deep archetype, the child archetype. And I spend a fair amount of pages discussing it in All You Need Is Myth.
Uh-huh.
And it's very interesting to me that both Dylan and Brian Wilson in the Beach Boys were probably the biggest musical influences of the Beatles. They were certainly their biggest competition through most of the 60s.
Hmm.
And both of those archetypes, the prophet and the child, are archetypes that prefigure the savior in most mythologies.
Hmm.
So once again, the rock mythology is unfolding and revealing itself to look very similar to ancient religions and mythologies. And of course, we can look at it now in hindsight. It's almost like now we can look through the opposite end of the telescope.
Hmm.
When it was occurring, everything was happening too fast for us to really notice what was happening. But 50, 60 years on, we can look back and we can look at the stories of all of these iconic rock stars, and we can look at the symbols that are associated with those rock stars, and they line up almost perfectly with these classic
stories. Yeah. And
yes.
Now, in real life, did these guys know each other? Did the Beach Boys hang out with Dylan or the Beatles, was this just emerging beyond?
Yeah, they knew each other.
They did.
They knew each other.
They hang out together?
Yeah.
Do they take drugs together?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Dylan turned the Beatles on to marijuana in 1964. And by 1965, they were unabashed Brian Wilson fans. Paul McCartney most certainly knew who his sort of melodic and musical songwriting challenge was coming from. And it's most exemplified in sort of this classic competition, I'm saying with quotes, where they were trying to top each other with every album. Brian Wilson heard Rubber Soul, said, "I'm going to make an album that's better than Rubber Soul." And he made Pet Sounds. And the Beatles heard Pet Sounds, and they thought, geez, what are we going to do to top this? Well, they did Sgt. Pepper. Those albums were all answers to each other.
Mm. Wow, like a call and response.
Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to go to a break soon, but I wanted to just put out a question to consider, which is whether or not these mythic archetypes, the innocent, the savior, the devil, the prophet, the witch, whether these actually did something to tear down the stability of society, and if so, then what did they replace it with? Like, how did the myth give society something else that it wanted? So let's talk about that when we come back from this break.
Okay. Yeah,
great question.
Yeah. Me and Del were singing. Other comments for you after the break. Okay, welcome back to the last segment of our show. Boy, it's gone fast this hour. We're talking to Steve Wagner, author of All You Need Is Myth, The Beatles and the Gods of Rock. The boards are lit. A lot of calls coming in. And we also have a text coming in from Gabby in New Jersey, who says, thanks for this sociological discussion. She says, the Zeitgeist, baby, the Zeitgeist. They did the Rolling Stones rock and roll circus together. John Lennon famously sang with Taj Mahal.
Yeah, he actually also did a couple of songs with a bit of a super group that contained Keith Richards on bass and Eric Clapton on lead guitar and Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience on drums. So yeah, that was one of their direct collaborations.
Jimi Hendrix was another one of the rock gods, right?
Absolutely. He's the magician. I discuss several of the shaman archetypes in All You Need Is Myth, Jimi Hendrix being the magician, Jim Morrison being the psychopomp, which is the shaman that guides the soul through the experience of death. Basically, Jim Morrison is the death archetype.
Wow.
Grace Slick is the witch archetype, and Janis Joplin is the oracle archetype. That's a very interesting chapter.
Yes, yes, fascinating. And Yoko Ono, is she an archetype?
Yeah. Well, yes, in conjunction with John Lennon, she is.
She's part of a dyad.
Yes, when you look at these classical mythologies, you see this motif over and over and over again. Shiva and Shakti, Zeus and Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, and of course, Jesus and Mary Magdalene. You see these pairings, and it's very pronounced in the Hindu religion and mythology.
Only in their case,
all of the male gods. Yes.
It's a living pantheon in this case.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's the lovers. Yes. Yeah.
You got some colors?
We have, the board is lit up. Okay, we've got at least five people, and we got 10 minutes. So everybody,
we'll try to keep it one minute.
We'll go quick.
Okay, here we go.
We're going to go quick, letting you know. We're going to start with who's been the most patient, Danny in King City. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Danny.
Hello, Steve. Hello, everybody else.
Hi, Danny.
You started touching on the question I wanted to ask a little bit ago before the break, which was most artists with lasting, let's say, power, let's say, eventually turn to the artistic side of music and start, you know, forgetting about the charts, right? They do it more for the art than the chart, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if the Beatles would have done this whole reflection of the social political environment of the time had they not jumped into the psychedelic drug that they started taking.
Well, I think would they have been...
Go ahead.
I think that's a very fascinating insight, and it's one that I discuss in the book, having to do with actually the theorized psychedelic roots of religions, ancient religions and mythologies.
Yeah.
Without getting into that in great detail here, I can say that the Beatles exhibiting the psychedelic aspect, exploring that, and then bringing that vibration, if for lack of a better word, to the people, this is actually quite a tried and true aspect of ancient mythologies.
Hmm. Yeah, Danny, thank you. I really appreciate the question. Yeah, we got to go.
I'd say there's more and more evidence to show many religions had their start with some psychedelics.
Yeah.
Okay, next we got Billy Sunshine. Hi, Billy.
Hey, Billy.
Hi, kids. Billy. So I wanted Hi, guys. Hello, everyone. So when I was with Bob, it was during the Christian years.
Bob Dylan.
I wondered what you made of his flirtation with Bob's flirtation with the Christian religion.
Well, I have just really a very, very short reference to it in the book. I use it as one example of Dylan maintaining mystery with his audience. He was just impossible to turn down, to summarize, to figure out.
To understand, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, he kept his personal life veiled to such a degree that the music was really all that did the talking. And now we look back with the time that's passed and we say, well, yeah, of course, he explored Christianity and it was reflected in two or three albums that were actually a lot better than people wanted to admit at the time. But in general, I think it's just another aspect of Dylan confounding his audience and making it all the more impossible to pin him down, because it was very unexpected when he did that. And just about the time people got used to it, he was on to another thing.
Thanks, Billy. We can keep going here. Hmm. Okay, now Steve from Pacific Grove. We knew Steve would be turned on by this topic. Steve, welcome to the show.
Yeah, we got a Jill Stephen King or we're forever in disgrace. No. Jim Morrison was like the savior type of archetype. Tell all the people that you see, follow me down. And wild child, full of grace, savior of the human race, your cool face. John and Paul both alternately thought sincerely that they were the second coming of Jesus. John admits that Jesus was his biggest.
What was that, Steve?
It's no surprise that that came to their minds and that they asked themselves that question. Because I think, as we all might agree, they had become as famous.
More famous than Jesus. Wasn't that the bumper sticker at the time?
Well, you know, actually his quote was, we're more popular than Jesus now. It was taken out of context in the United States quite a bit.
Why, was there a Harris poll or something? I mean, how did they know that?
What he meant was that because of the media and the television and the and the media, that they have reached 20,000 times more people. That's what he meant.
But what I
want to say is this. Without a hero, if he'd have told me this 10 years ago that I need to save America because they're too stupid to save themselves, without it, I'd have said you're crazy. But now I understand that we are like a vertebra in a snake's body without a hero, without a head on that snake. And if you don't have that head on the snake, and it might as well be a rock star because they're up front, they're out there, they have a magical, like a golf pro doing magical things, you know, with the golf ball or with their brains or their songs. They really get your attention. And if you can't trust a genius, are you really going to trust a politician and run your life the way you're doing?
Good point. Thanks for that,
I might have to put that in the sequel, Steve. that's a great line.
All right, I think we've got to keep going, everybody. Where time is running out here. We still have folks who want to comment.
Thanks, Steve. That was great.
Are you good, Steve?
Yeah, thanks.
Yes, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Steve from Pacific Grove. We're going to go to Nick from Royal Oaks. Hi, Nick.
Hey, did the Beatles get into Russia easier than Brittany Griner? What was the origin of them going into them? It was during wartime. There's a communist bloc in there. And the reception, was it all what was sung about?
About Russia?
Good
you
question.
Know what that... That is such an interesting angle, and yet another one that I did a fair amount of research on and considered including in All You Need Is Myth, which was their impact behind the Iron Curtain. Rock and roll was illegal in Russia in the 60s, and I believe the 70s as well. And the bands, the people over there, they didn't call them rock and roll bands. They called them Beatle bands. And the kids that were growing up under that oppressive regime, they knew that there was a phenomenon occurring throughout the world that they were not being allowed to participate in. And I think it's very, very interesting. And I've heard Gorbachev has talked about this, and I believe even Putin has referenced this, the idea that the kids of the 60s and 70s who were obsessed with the Beatles but did not have easy access to the music and certainly couldn't participate in the mania aspect that was unfolding throughout the world. That was the same age group that in 1989 were now the adults pulling the levers of power. In other words, and I will quote Keith Richards on this, because how can you not quote Keith Richards whenever you have the opportunity to do so? He always said it wasn't bullets and bombs that brought down that wall. It was rock and roll.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And I think he's right.
Yeah. I heard of these great parties in Moscow just before the wall fell.
Exactly.
Yeah, apparently it was, you know, they were like rave situations.
Well,
going on.
Here we are in the last minute of the show. Has reality recovered from the shift in our mythic culture? And
or what's the new myth? Are there newer rock stars coming out that we should pay attention to?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. I think the easy answer to that is no. That's not where the next mythology is going to blossom. Oh. It certainly seems that the next mythology will most likely blossom through the internet and through technology in some capacity.
Social media, maybe?
Yes, because that is now the new language that we're communicating with. The Beatles and the Stones and Dylan and Beach Boys, Joni Mitchell, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, they already established that for popular music. The next mythology has to come from somewhere else.
Oh. Pink Floyd?
Steve, it's
been great.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be talking about them at great length in the second book.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Great.
Steve,
we're running out of time,
thank
Steve.
You so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for being on
thank
our show.
Thank you so much. Love you guys.
Love you too. Steve Wagner, All You Need Is Myth, The Beatles, and the Gods of Rock.
KSCO, Santa Cruz.